This episode of Scene Report is brought to you by Flower World. Flower World is a decentralized worker-owned tattoo studio in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, which is where I live and where I'm recording this right now, that offers tattooing, art shows, teach-ins, workshops, and more. They offer a broad spectrum of tattooing styles from fine line black and gray to color traditional, portraits, and decorative black work. Flower World's resident artists are Tamara Santibanez, Nassim Dayoub, Nas Dynasty, Christina Gamora, Virginia Elwood, and they host a wide range of visiting guest artists. Honestly, anytime that an establishment is worker-owned, I really think you should be giving your money to that place. But all of the artists at Flower World are legit, straight-up legends in New York City. Nassim plays in the coolest new punk band in New York, Pure Terror, and is just a total leader in the spaces of direct action, mutual aid, community support in the New York punk scene. Virginia has been tattooing for over two decades, worked at New York Adorned and co-owned Saved Tattoo. Christina was a total legend in the underground punk scene before she even moved to New York City and is also a practicing herbalist, combines that stuff with her tattoo work. Nas is fascinated by art history and brings her knowledge of that space to make a completely distinctive style of work. And Tamara, who specializes in Chicano style tattooing, also does visual arts, oral history, is a committed prison abolitionist, and is the only person who came on my old podcast, Protest and Survive, two times. So if you have a sense of what Scene Report is about, if you have a sense of what Protest and Survive is about, Flower World is a shop that I fuck with. I've known a lot of the people who work there for a long time. I've known Tamara for like a really long time, since we were like 18 years old. And beyond the fact that the art that they're making on people's bodies are truly beautiful, and I hope I can get more tattoos from them, just like their whole approach to what tattooing and what art can be, I really fuck with. It's worth checking out. It's worth supporting them, getting a tattoo from them. And if you mention this ad from Scene Report when you get a tattoo from them, you will get a free tote bag or bandana. So thank you to Flower World for all that you do. And now let's listen to this episode. Episode 2, Scene Report. Was good. This is your host, Reed Dunley, recording live from my kitchen in Brooklyn, doing this thing live to tape. This whole podcast is live to tape, more or less. That's the vibe. Radio style shit. Kind of rocking with that. But thank you for tuning in. Episode 2. This is a fun episode for me. We got Fat Tony up on here. What's particularly fun about it, there's a lot of reasons, honestly. Just talking to this guy is fun in general. But me and Tony have been talking about him coming on this podcast for like a minute, because this iteration of this podcast kind of like has gone through a whole bunch of different changes at different times, different ideas I was working with, different groups of people I was working with it on. And like, I reached out to Tony like literally years ago. I don't remember how many, like maybe honestly even like pre-COVID times or like early pandemic times at the least. But like, we stuck with it. We hit each other back and forth for a while. And now we did the damn thing. And I'm excited for y'all, the listener, to hear this conversation. The first time I heard this guy's name straight up was like walking into a house party in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Very randomly, like friend of a friend thing. And they were like, Fat Tony just like played or just DJed or some shit. And I was like, oh shit, I'm supposed to know that person's name. People are talking about, they know that person's name, whatever. I didn't really know who Fat Tony was. I don't know what year that was. Probably like, I don't know, 2013, 2014 or something. And then it turned out like all the people at this party were like Houston people. And not like people I knew, but people who were friends with people that I knew in Texas. I love Texas. I started going to Austin, Texas, probably in like 2010, something like that. And I've been kind of going there a lot Since then, briefly lived in Austin, Texas for like 6 months or so. Spent a bit of time out in West Texas. I've spent some time in Houston now. I've traveled around, like gone to shows all over that that state, whatever. And like the thing I like about Tony is like Tony is so Texas in so many ways. Like he's such a storyteller on a basic level in his music. He's a hustler. We talk about this in the interview. He's like a DIY hustler. He's kind of like always like making shit happen for himself in a way that like coming from the punk scene, which is where I come from more, like a DIY thing is, you know, legit and like a part of my community and a part of the stuff that like I'm about and have been about. But like what I love about Tony's approach is like it's a DIY thing, but he like spins that into a more like commercial music industry to like make opportunities for himself and like do it for himself. And I really respect it and I really enjoy watching it. And there's some other Texas homies who I see do stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, beyond that, he's just like a friendly ass motherfucker. He's witty. He like listens, cares, makes eye contact. He's like Texas in so many ways, but also you can like, you can hear it in his music a lot too. Like even like beyond like what his more straight up hip hop sounds like, you also hear these other like homages to different types of Texas music and like country music and Tejano music. And like, it's cool. I really like what he's doing. Like, you know, I think early on when I started understanding or hearing more about Tony, like I then was like, oh, he's like got tracks with like the ASAP people and he's like doing stuff with like Das Racist. And like, he's kind of like in a world where I'm like, this is kind of like a legit rapper, but he's also like, you know, DJing or playing like a house party in Williamsburg that like I'm ending up at. This isn't the first time I interviewed him. We did an interview in like an alleyway off of Dirty Six in Austin, like during South by Southwest. Like he played some sort of showcase thing. And then I was working for this news website called Circa. We had been like, had planned on doing an interview there. And then like the gig was over, the party was over. And we like stepped out like into like an alley and did like an interview like next to a dumpster, right? Which like, I'm down at South by Southwest. Like I got a camera person with me. I got a nice camera. I'm doing like kind of like proper interviews and not that many where we're just like, yeah, let's go do it next to the dumpster. Cause that's like straight up the best place to actually do this right now. And Tony's down. And like, yeah, again, I'm still messing around with the whole format of this thing, but I have decided that like giving a little bit of an intro, letting y'all know before we get into this why I'm interested in this artist is probably a useful thing. We talk about rap. We talk about Houston rap. We talk about other types of rap. We talk about like just being a music nerd in general and sort of like how Tony sort of found his scene and his people by like listening to music, especially like finding music on the internet and finding really niche music and kind of being like open to all that. We talk about his dad immigrating from Nigeria. We talk about like one of my favorite like interviews I did like late at my time at Rolling Stone was with Maxo Cream from Houston, and Maxo's dad is from Nigeria. And like, we kind of talk about like what that was like and growing up in Houston and his family's place in that city. We talk about a bunch of shit. I think you're going to like it. I appreciate you tuning in. This is episode 2 of this podcast. I'm really happy with how the first one with Johnny Hummus came out. If you haven't listened to that one yet, after this one is over, go and check that one out. I got another one in the bag. It's going to be coming out soon. I appreciate everybody who's kind of reached out on this, everybody who's shared this, everyone who's like been about this project. Like, have a lot of people who have been like directly involved in this project, but like I appreciate all the love and attention to like to what we're doing with this thing, cuz it's fun and it ain't a thing if I don't have listeners. So that's you. So, thanks for tuning in. I'm stoked for this interview. Me and Fat Tony, we're both kitchen guys. I'm in the kitchen now. This podcast gets made in my kitchen, more or less. So, like, join us in the kitchen for season 1, episode 2, scene report. I have COVID right now, by the way. Fat Tony, let's go. All right, scene report. We're in the kitchen in Brooklyn with Fat Tony. What's good?
The kitchen's one of my favorite places to be. If you catch me at a house party, I'm probably in the kitchen or in somebody's room ducking off trying to talk to somebody.
I love chilling in the kitchen like all night at the house party.
Yes.
Like sitting on the counter.
Fuck yes.
Close to the fridge. People are coming in and out. It's the like, it's a lively place. Do you cook?
I don't really cook that much. Like my partner is definitely more to cook. Like all I make is like fucking pasta and easy bullshit. Like I've never really gotten into cooking. I think I should though one day. You're a cooking man?
I cook. Yeah. And I didn't cook for the longest time either. I didn't really cook like a little bit growing up, but like I learned eventually. Now I love it. It's like, it's kind of how I relax in a lot of ways. Feel at the same time, it stresses me out too, because I spend all this time like going to the farmer's market and the grocery store and the Asian supermarket and this and that. And then I'm like, I got to eat all this food before it goes bad. Like yeah. I stress myself out, you know, but I love to cook. It's fun.
I'm bad at that. And I hate being wasteful. That's kind of why I don't cook as much as I should. Cause I really just don't want to just like, cause I also hate cooking a big meal and then I have to eat it for the rest of the week.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the same thing.
Yeah,
I guess in a degrading form, you know.
Totally. And I want to actually ask you about this band at some point. And you were taking a photo of this banner Riley. In my other room of Riley. But like, this is just like a silly ass aside. But I don't know if you ever saw that. Like, they did this like PBS video about Power Trip playing at South by Southwest. It was mad funny.
I never saw that.
You're going to fucking love it. This guy was at PBS for like a year or two making these like kind of like almost mockumentary vibe videos. And he did this video where he like embedded with Power Trip for like a day at South by. And like,
that like, must have been hectic.
Total aside, but there's this like moment where like Blake is making a salad and he's like talking about how it's the same way. I'm pretty sure he's joking, but he's talking about how he likes to like create a riff in the same way he likes to create a salad and put all these different ingredients in and like let his creativity out and try new things. I was like, this is too funny.
Power Trip definitely has some good TV moments. They have some good Fox News moments. Like, you know,
yeah, what was that? That rings a bell.
There was a guy that I think Riley was beefing with on Fox News. He was like a correspondent that might be a metalhead rocker or
this
some
is
type
so
of shit.
Familiar. Yeah,
it was like a few months before Riley passed away, and it was fucking hilarious.
And wasn't Ice-T in the mix on that a little bit?
Yes, because Body Count and had just did a song with Riley.
Yeah.
I love Ice-T, by the way. I actually saw Body Count with Riley, I think, at Fun 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 Fest one year. And fucking Coco was there backstage with, like, all their kids. It was sick.
One of the most, like, legendary moments of, like, DIY punk in New York in, like, 2018. We were talking about 2017 last night.
Great year.
They did a Body Count music video shoot in Bushwick. And this is when Frosties still existed, which was like this like delivery nutcracker, like a frozen nutcracker delivered. And there was a Body Count music video shoot. What is the name of the song? Talk Shit, Get Shot. New school,
I think I know
body
what you're
count.
Talking about. I
and like all the punks in Brooklyn like pulled up to this video shoot and like moshed like crazy for a music video, like totally like fake show, and like we're drinking a lot and ended up happening. It was just like the funniest day. And Coco was there, all the Zulu Nation people were there, like,
wow,
jackets and shit. It was like such a fucking funny day. There's some great photos.
I mean, there was definitely a lot of interestingly goofy shit happening in 2010s music. Like, I remember going to a Trash Talk show in L.A. and fucking Suge Knight and Cat Williams pulled up.
What year was that?
That had to be...
Right in the same zone.
That had to be, like, 2015.
Okay.
Because I brought my homegirl who was pregnant at the time. First of all, it was wild that I took her to a Trash Talk show. And
your
homegirl
being
pregnant.
The person that you're dating, your homegirl.
No. Just my friend.
Just your pregnant friend.
From like childhood, yeah. Right? Not my kid. She was at the show
in this pregnant economy?
As fuck. Like, superty duperty, obviously pregnant as fuck.
Yeah.
And nothing scared me more about her safety than Suge Knight coming in the room. And people were getting hit, kicked in the head, lots of drinking. That was fine.
Crowd killing.
But Suge Knight coming
head in. Head walking.
A fucking guy climbed on top of the speakers and got butt ass naked doing a trash talk show and was like screaming the words.
It was Cat Williams.
It should have been Cat Williams. Luckily, that happened right before Cat Williams and Suge Knight got there. I wish it happened after they got there because they could have got a dose of some realness.
All right, we got to walk it back a little bit. And I'm going to get back to some of these topics just a tiny bit. But while we're at it, who is Fat Tony? And what's the Fat Tony scene?
I would say Fat Tony is an artist that is community oriented. You know, I'm the kind of artist that has never really done anything that wasn't a collaboration of some sorts. You know, like I always work with a producer. I always have features. I always work with a promoter. I always work with an agent. Like everything I do for my practice is with other people. And I kind of like the freedom of being a solo artist and getting to pair myself with different people from time to time, which feels way more fun and less rigid than being in like a band or a group where it's like these 3, 4, 5, 6 people have to be a part of every project. And I think that it's like something that really drew me to music because I grew up, as far as music goes, I was kind of a loner when it came to music. You know what I mean? So much of the music that I was into, I didn't have tons of IRL friends that were into it. I had a lot of friends on the internet.
Because it went across genres or some shit? Or?
Yeah, I like think not only because it went across genres, but a lot of it was honestly very niche. You know what I mean? Like, and also when I was coming up in the 2000s, I feel like genres and scenes were more separatist. Like, I had friends who only liked backpack rap music, indie rap music. If I mentioned a Jay-Z song around them, they would think it was stupid. Then I had friends who liked radio music, radio rap, 106 and Park, and never knew who MF Doom was. And then I had friends who were into all various strains of punk and hardcore. Some of them only liked hardcore. And if I mentioned a pop punk band, it was whack. Some of my friends only liked pop punk and some of their vibes were a little too twee for me. But on the internet, I would find kinship with mad people who had an interest in all types of music. You know what I mean?
Message boards?
Definitely. Heavily on message boards. I was on IRC. Chat rooms, you know what I mean? I was deeply, deeply into computers since 1999 when I went to sixth grade. My like dad is an engineer, so he's always been about tech. Like there was always some form of a computer in my house. He like showed me the internet, you know what I mean? Like I always had access to it at school and at home. Really at home is where I got deep into it. You know, especially when I finally got my own PC in my bedroom. Game changer. I'm on SoulSeek all fucking day. I'm on every message board. I'm still on IRC. I'm gaming. You know what I mean?
You're staying up till 3 in the morning and skipping your homework?
Yes, yes. And I'm really not hanging out with too many people. Like most of my in real life socializing came from me making music. Like playing in bands with people, trying to jam with people, recording with people, playing shows. That's when I really started to put myself out there. Prior to that, I felt kind of shy.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
what was like your first instrument that you loved playing?
My first instrument was bass guitar, because I fucking loved. I always loved how bass was like in like my mind the like glue of any band. I love how it's rhythmic, and I love how it provides melody too. I probably sound so fucking basic, but that's really what like drew me to it. And it was the first instrument I had access to because I had a friend whose sister played in some church band and was selling her old bass for $50. And I was like, I can do a little quick summer job and get $50, no problem. And now I have a bass.
Yeah.
So that was my first.
You still got that bass?
I do still have it. It's fucking covered in stickers and very ugly.
Yeah.
You know what? If I could turn back the hands of time, the instrument that I wish I put the most time into when I was a kid is DJing. Because as an adult, I feel like becoming a DJ is the musical thing that has changed my life the most, because it helps me to understand how songs work, how to arrange a song, what's the most effective part of a song to an audience, you know, and that's absolutely informed how I write music. It also allows me to put all of my interest and my taste and my influences all into one thing, like being able to kind of show people that there is a thread between this artist and that artist that on paper you might think don't make sense together, but I'm gonna find a way for you to get it. You know what I mean? Whether that's like playing on a sample in a song, whether that's, burped my ass off. Whether that's looping like a lyric in the song that another song from another genre has and like making those match together, like that is, and to be honest, rap music is my home and I feel like the DJ is the foundation of that genre, and I really regret not getting into it earlier in my life. Like I started rapping maybe when I was 13. But I didn't start to DJ until I was like 24 in a real way.
That's interesting too, because I feel like part of the reason why I've always fucked with your vibe musically and just on like a straight vibe level, personal level, is that like I can see right away that like you're a student of music and lots of types of music, and you got the soul seek and whatever. And as you mentioned last night when we were fucking around, walking around Houston Street, your mom was a music student or whatever. Yeah. So I feel like it makes sense to hear that like you're getting so much out of DJing and figuring that out. I mean, this is kind of like stupid or self-evident or whatever. Yeah, you're a student of music, right? We all are, right? But like also you've also said you're a fan of music, right? And I can tell that like you like all this different shit, because I hear songs of yours like, oh, we got this song here where I don't know if you call that a sample or not, but it's like, here's the Texas Tornadoes song, like, yeah, you like that, like a lot of people don't like that, you know what I mean? Like I feel like there's all these different things coming out in your sound, so placing an importance on DJing makes sense to me for like what you're about.
Definitely, it's probably my favorite thing to do, because I think that
you were having a blast last night. I could see that.
Yeah, like as a DJ I can of course play my own material, but I can also play other songs. And I think that just allows me to express myself in a way that's fuller.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I have always viewed being a DJ as a therapeutic thing for me. Like, whether I'm at home practicing or I'm out playing, it's the thing I do that's very physical too. And I really feel like I get, you know, I like have a weight lifted off me. Like honestly, if I'm ever going through something, I'm like feeling down or I'm frustrated or I'm angry about something, going out to DJ soothes me.
Yeah, that's cool. Kind of getting back to my first question a little bit.
Sorry, I know I went all over the place.
No, you're good. You're good. I like the interviews that kind of go all over the place and I don't have to really throw it in there that much, but we still didn't get, I think we started to get at what's the Fat Tony scene. I don't know if we fully got there. And maybe a way to also preface that is like, what do you think your genre is? Like, how do you describe, like, I'm a rapper, I'm an indie rapper, I'm just fucking Fat Tony. Like, how do you talk about yourself and how do you think about yourself and like the scene and the world musically that you fit into?
I definitely identify as a rapper, and I mean rapper, because I've always thought that people saying that, oh, I'm not a rapper, I'm an MC, was some bullshit and just very like full of themselves. Not to downplay the term of being an MC, but I think being a rapper is something that you should be proud of. I would say most people would have to put me in the box of an indie rapper because of the artists that I've worked with the most, people like Murs, you know, the type of artists that I'm friends with throughout all these years have always been people who kind of fall in that indie rap lane. Even though I don't think that my music has always fit in that style or in that sound, I would say for the simple fact that I'm friends with people in the scene that you would call indie rap, I'm often booked alongside people in that scene. I've always put out my music on freaking Bandcamp. For all those reasons, I'd have to say that that's the main community that I belong to in underground music.
Yeah, that helps clarify it. And obviously, it's all fluid, right? You know what I mean? And it's funny to even hear that because it's right. Like, again, I'm full of stupid questions here today, but it's like, you know, you're a Bandcamp guy. Whereas like if you were putting your music out a few years ago on SoundCloud, does that put you in a whole other different scene? I mean, I'm really only kind of like asking these questions just because like the show is called Scene Report. And I'm kind of curious about like people's community and where they sit or whatever. But I think like that's kind of like the most, on a certain level, that's kind of the most basic shit, right? It's like a question of sound, but it's also just a question of like, who do you fuck with? Like, who are your friends? Who are you booking? Who's booking you? Like, you can see even like we've talked about, like I'm more into like punk shit or I have it in punk shit where it's like, but you could see a band playing indie rock at a punk show and it's kind of a punk show, you know what I mean? Or totally. They're kind of a punk band because they're in with that crowd, like a band like, I'm thinking of a band like Merchandise or something.
Yes.
Or like even maybe slightly a band that we both like, Porches, right?
Yes.
Like maybe they're like kind of a punk band even though they don't really sound like what you would think of a punk band is, because that's who they play with.
I definitely think that the format that you put out music on has a lot to do with your genre and your scene. I mean, it's like really obvious with like the UK scene, like C86 or whatever, that like twee music that was all on like tapes. There's a certain type of underground rock band that currently only puts out music on tape versus vinyl. There's a certain kind of rapper who puts out music on SoundCloud in the 2010s versus Bandcamp in the 2010s. And I think that a lot of time it is just like the circumstance of like the era that the artist is coming up in. Like the only reason why I started putting out music on Bandcamp is because Bandcamp, I got on that in 2008 when it was new, and that was during the iTunes era. And I found it easier for me just to upload my music to Bandcamp and then sell it. And I was coming out of like Meter Fire links and stuff where any music I made, I'm trying to give it out for free and like get as many people to download the, you know, MP3 as possible. And Bandcamp was the first thing that I saw that I could just from my bedroom sell my own files, sell my music. Whereas to get my stuff on iTunes, I typically had to go through a company and like pay for it. And this is before there was a DistroKid and all that. It was just the easiest method. So that's why I used it. If I was coming up in the 90s, I probably would have only put out my music on CD because that was an easy format then. You know, call up the disc makers people, pay a few hundred bucks, get a shit ton of CDs made, you know? So I think that I think it's really important to take advantage of like the current shit happening around you. Like I've never been the kind of person who's like, oh, I have to do it the old school way. Like, oh, I'm not going to use Ableton. I'm going to use a MPC or whatever. Like I'm always about using whatever is readily available, the easiest to get to, and is going to help me get this idea out of my brain.
That's interesting to hear you talk about because it's like, I was watching this like old interview with you from like 2016, this era that we keep on coming back to.
Mm-hmm. Our youth.
And it was with like a Houston outlet. And they like, I don't know if they, in the title, it called you a DIY hustler. Right. Mm-hmm. And like, obviously, like, I don't know if you ever like said that term yourself or not, but like, obviously you like are about DIY and you get it and you like literally do shit yourself or whatever. And there's like something to that where it's like my frame reference of DIY can be, yeah, you go do it yourself, but then you end up like limiting yourself because it like has to be purely DIY. Yeah. Whereas like you kind of like do DIY in the truer sense of like, I'm doing it myself, but like I'm going as far as I can go with it. You know what I mean? Like I'm going to be on like a fucking ASAP Rocky song, but I'm a DIY guy.
I play like Silent Barn like every other month back
yeah,
then.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to play Silent Barn and then this track is going to have like 20 million streams or whatever. And I'm like kind of like in it and I'm going to go where I can go. And that's like pretty interesting. Like, I don't know how many other people are like doing that exactly. I'm sure some are. I just don't know about it.
I mean, I think it might be due to the fact that I didn't have tons of homies around me making music. So I didn't have anyone who was older than me or like the big homie to me to like give me the rule book on like what is the do's and don'ts of like DIY or punk or whatever. So I just literally followed anything that made sense. Like the whole reason why I started booking shows, which is what got me into music, is
when you were how old?
When I was 15.
Yeah.
There was this Minor Threat DVD that was new at the time of all these old shows from like the 80s of them. And the bonus feature was an interview with Ian MacKay, the singer. And he was talking about how they book their own tours and they record themselves and they save the money to buy a van and all this shit. And I saw that. And at the time, I think he must have been like 18, 19 years old. And I'm looking at him like, yo, he's a kid like me. Why can't I do that and not just do that with my friends that I'm trying to have a band with, but my friends that I rap with? Like, let's just do it all ourselves. Like, we don't have to. Like, I had never heard of that idea before. Like, previously, I thought in the old school way, like, oh, someone has to find me and I got to get signed and then I'll be able to put out a record. And I just skipped all that. And was like, yo, let me figure out how to do as much as I can on my own. That's why I started booking shows, because I want to know how shows should run when I play them. Like, I booked shows to maybe like 2 years in high school before I ever played. You know what I mean? I like tried to learn how to record myself. I bought mics. I bought the software. Like, I started messing around with beats. Like, I tried everything I could to do whatever it takes to get my music out there. And if it felt like something wasn't a good fit, like when I started making beats at first, I wasn't super great at it. So rather than spend all my time trying to perfect my mix on my beats, I'm like, all right, I have an idea of the kind of beats that I want to rap on. Let me go find people, whether they're in my town or in another state or whatever, that kind of have the same vibe as me, that kind of like the same stuff as me, and just work with them, and I'll concentrate on being the best rapper.
So now, is this what you're talking about? Is this in the Simply Throwed, Team Renegade, and the Low Ends era, or is this in the Cactus Music era?
This is like more in like Simply Throwed and Team Renegade. Like this is like Low Ends. This is like my junior and senior year of high school.
Word.
Like that's really when I started to get the idea like I should really make music. And like not in a way like, oh, I'm going to be famous or whatever. Like I thought, all right, if I get a head start now, I'll always have this outlet as an option for a thing to do. And if I can do it as my job, that'll be great. But I'm not limited to just winning or being a big star. I want to make music no matter what, because it's fun and it makes me feel good and it helps me express things that I can't really just say out loud sometimes.
Now, I maybe want to bring it back even earlier than high school for a second.
Take it back.
The first time I went, and this doesn't have to be earlier than high school or whatever, but the first time I went to Houston, I had such a bad time in Houston, and it was just
because
some bullshit happened. My friend's like indie rock band was doing like a US tour, and they played at a place called
White Swan.
No, like Super Fun Happy.
Super Happy Fun Land.
Yeah.
That's where I booked all my first shows.
So they played at this spot, and I could tell it's like a cool spot or whatever, but like whatever was going on that night, like they were not vibing with the locals there. It was like some older, like white redneck folk around. And like they kind of like got into some shit with them a little bit earlier on, just like not a big deal, but like not particularly friendly words. And then, you know, this was just like such a like Bobo tour. We like, you know, parked the minivan in the venue, went to sleep like on the ground of like the 100-degree venue in the middle of the night.
What year was this?
2009 probably. Wow. And then all the guys kind of came back and like were tripping on acid or tripping on something and like turned on the amps and kind of were going crazy at like 3 a.m. It was just like a weird, bizarre experience. Wow. And then I was always like, all right, well, I guess like fuck Houston. I guess I don't know. I was a kid. I don't know any better. And then I go back to Houston 10 years later, finally, and then start spending time in Houston. And I'm like, oh, I fucking love this city,
yeah.
But I still don't know shit about it. You know, I've been there for like 2 days at a time, 3 days at a time, maybe on a tour here or there. I went to Day for Night one time.
Amazing festival.
Which was fun.
Played that one. Love that shit.
Yeah, you might have even played that year that I was there. It was when Solange and Nine Inch Nails and Cardi B and whoever else played. And then we ran over to Walters and saw Iron Age and Judge, which was crazy. And then I went back a few times since then. I was just like, this is a sick city. Yeah. So anyways, I'm just like, I'm curious, like, what's your thoughts on Houston? What's your thoughts on the rap scene in Houston? I mean, I don't really know a whole lot more than DJ Screw or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know a lot about Houston. So I'm just kind of like curious about the city because I want to know more about it. I want to spend more time there. And like, I know you're from the Third Ward.
Yes.
What does that mean to be from the Third Ward? How did your family end up in Houston? Tell me like any of the shit that you feel like talking about on that level.
So let's start with Houston rap, which I think is the most important influence in my life. I think I'm so lucky to have grown up when I grew up because all of my grade school life, there were Houston rappers all around me making great music who were famous and on the radio and also local. So I never had it in my head that you couldn't be a real artist coming from where I'm coming from. Like, some of my earliest memories of watching music videos are like a Scarface video, Ghetto Boys video, you know, Jay-Z and UGK, the Big Pimpin' video. Then going to my high school years of 2002 to 2006, Houston's on fucking fire. You have all the Houston rap stuff goes top 10, top 40 Billboard charts from Paul Wall to Chamillionaire to Mike Jones to Slim Thug, all that shit. And you have the NBA All-Star Game happening in Houston, the Super Bowl happening in Houston. So my whole upbringing, I was like, wow, anything's possible. Like, I never thought to myself that, like, I couldn't be on the level of the artist that I look up to. Far as like greatness and like having fans and all that, right? Now, being from Third Ward is really important because it's one of the most historic black neighborhoods in Houston. My mom's side of the family has been in Third Ward for generations, honestly.
How many generations, you know?
My grandmother, my mom's mom, is from Crockett, Texas. She moved to Houston. And my grandfather, my mom's dad, his family had always been in the Third Ward area, right? Like, most of my mother's family that lives in Houston mostly live in Third Ward. Like, my whole life growing up, I didn't really have to venture too much outside of my neighborhood. And I think it's so interesting how it's a neighborhood where you have two different colleges. You have the University of Houston. You have Texas Southern University, which is an HBCU. You have the new Black Panther parties there. you have famous artists coming from there, like John Biggers. You have, you know, actors coming from there, like Debbie Allen. You have the whole gamut of Black America there, from like street dudes to doctors, you know what I mean? And I think seeing people in all of those roles with Black faces my whole life also had an influence on me the same way Houston rap did of anything in this world's possible. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I have never lived outside of Third Ward anytime I've lived in Houston, whether it's living with my parents or getting my own apartment. It's always been the home for me. If I ever were to live in Houston again, I'd absolutely live in Third Ward because that's where I feel the most comfortable.
That's where George Floyd was from too, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You weren't around then though. You had left. You were in New York at that point?
When like the 2020 shit happened?
Yeah.
Yeah, I had moved out of Houston for the last time in 2016.
Word. Did you know his music?
No, I mean, I, like many people, I only noticed he had a flow on like a Screw tape after he passed. And I always loved Screw. So there's a chance I could have heard it before, but never thought twice about it. Because when it comes to those Screw tapes, I would always look out for the artists that I knew of. So I'm waiting for like a Fat Pat flow, a Young Star flow, a Lil Flip flow. And their crew was so deep and was so welcoming that you would have like random people who have maybe never rapped on anything else but a Screw tape once or twice in their life on his records. So if it was anyone that I didn't hear of that had some non-Screw tape music out there, then I just never thought twice about it. But it is really crazy that just like the symbolism of George Floyd being from Third Ward and shaking up the world and it happening in Minneapolis, which is another really important music city that I've always loved. The fact that he was down with Screwed Up Click, like you can't make this shit up. You know what I mean? I would have never imagined that a member of Screwed Up Click would get murdered by a cop and change the world.
In Minneapolis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I was actually just...
I mean, like I said before, you can make anything happen coming from Third Ward, for real. Even in your death, you can make shit change. It's amazing.
Yeah, I was actually just out there for this 3-year anniversary of his death. I had never been to Minneapolis before. And my girlfriend's working on a documentary out there around George Floyd Square. So I was out there just seeing the community that was made around that fucking horrible thing that happened. Like you said, shit happens in people's death too, you know?
Yeah, man. I have a poem that I wrote around that time called When the Black Lives Matter Signs Come Down. And I was always just waiting for when every business that put a sign up or made some kind of virtue signaling post would start to backtrack. That was like the main thing on my mind when all that shit was happening, because every company, especially every company that I ever worked with, was hitting me up like, hey, can we do some type of content around this? Because we really feel bad and we want to support, and just a bunch of emptiness. I feel like you can better support people and show that you have empathy and you care by educating yourself. And you can do that in silence.
Yeah. And like, I feel like the clunkiness around the way that white America, corporate America, people of power respond to that shit, the way that you like see how silly some of the things that people said were, it's like, yeah, you don't like... This is the first time you thought about this, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't think about this ever before. And not to say that, like, thinking about it makes anything different, but, like, it was shocking to see how fucking fake some of it all was, you know?
Yeah. And
I want to hear that poem.
And I don't blame anyone for, like, not having an understanding of something that's very foreign to them. I just think you don't have to be so fucking performative about it. Like, you can truly keep that shit to yourself and learn on your own. Maybe have a conversation with someone else who is finding out about the same thing that you are discovering around the same time. That sounds healthier than trying to go to the, you know, fucking oppressed for the fucking oppressed person and ask for them to forgive you, or go to them just to check if they're not mad at you or whatever. Like, it's not about that. That does nothing for people that suffer under the hands of that ideology.
People just need to shut the fuck up sometimes.
Definitely. Like when like I'm in the wrong or I'm ignorant about something, I don't get loud about it. I go learn. And then I'm like, damn, I can't believe I didn't think about this before. And it's fine. Like, I feel like every human being has something that might seem very commonplace to another person from a different place or a different background or a different lifestyle. And when you find out about it, you're like, damn, I never thought about it like that. And to the other person, they might be like, you idiot, why have you never thought about this? But I think that that's fair, because everybody has a different experience. It's just how you go about, you know, moving forward from that moment. You can double down on your ignorance like many people do, which I think is silly and does nothing for anybody, not even for you, the person that is doubling down, except appease your fucking ego. And where does that get you?
It brings me to another thing I want to ask about, but before I do, I'm also going to ask you, how'd your dad end up in Houston?
So my dad is from Nigeria, fought in the Nigerian Civil War in 69, moved to the U.S. in his early 20s, maybe he was 20 or 21, and he worked some odd jobs, was even a janitor at some point.
Straight to Houston?
No, he first moved to Oklahoma, but found it to be too cold, and then moved to Houston, where there's a big Niger population. I think he had some friends or some friends of his family that were there, so he thought it'd be a good place to set roots. And he met my mom because he was in college taking a German class, and my mom was a TA in his class and stepped to him and was like, yo, you are really doing so fucking poorly in this class. You need to drop it. And then they started dating.
Did he drop it?
I don't know, actually. But I do like the idea of like, oh, I'm failing. Like, can I take you out? You know what I mean?
Yeah, like I'm distracted. Yeah.
Pardon me for my fucking belching. It's just this white label yerba mate. I've been burping all motherfucking day. I feel like Wimpy or something.
You were like quietly belching over there, and I just audibly belched straight into the microphone. If anyone's listening back to that, that audible belch was me, not Tony.
Yo, man, burp with us. Take a shot every time you hear us burp, man.
Burp with us.
New drinking game.
Maxo Cream's dad from Nigeria too, right? Mm-hmm. Have you guys talked about that?
Never talked about dads, but I love Maxo Cream. I fucking made a song with him almost 10 years ago, and he was one of the best rappers that I barely knew that I've ever worked with. I met him at a restaurant randomly for this Twitter meetup.
What restaurant?
Chacho's. Which is a ratchet ass Mexican restaurant with horrible food and strong drinks. And you only really go there if you're 21 or 22 and you're drunk leaving the club.
Yeah, I think the name says that.
Yes. Yes. For sure. We were there for a Twitter meetup hosted by Shea Serrano. And me and Maxo Cream came and I met him. I was like, yo, you have some fire music. He's like a little bit younger than me. I made this song. And I was like, yo, I want to get Maxo on it. I hit him up like a true gentleman. He came to my studio on time, bust out the verse, had one friend with him, kicked it with us, smoked, and then dipped. Whereas some, you know, that is one reason why I've always kind of really liked working with like street rappers or gangster rappers or whatever, because typically they more about their fucking business. Like they will pull up. They're not ever like super late in my fucking experience. It's like really about like, yo, you've asked me to do this. Maybe we have some type of payment arrangement. I'm here to do my job. Thank you. Whereas like a lot of these like indie rappers, hipster rappers who are full of clout and bullshit, they be showing up hella late. They be high. It's just clear to me that certain people who have had their back against the wall, when they have new opportunities in life, they approach them with the utmost respect and seriousness. And I always appreciate that. And I say that as a non-street person at all. I'm involved in no gangsterism ever.
Gangsterism is a good word. Who's been the latest?
Latest rapper I've ever worked with?
Yeah. And that don't, no shows are like not in that category. Actually showed up, but how much later?
Probably my music producer, Goldeneye, aka Tom Cruise, who's one of my best friends. One time we had a show in freaking Chicago, and this is while we were living in Brooklyn. And we get to the airport, and as we're walking up to like TSA, it dawns on him that he's at the wrong airport because we bought our flights separately. But he
in
just,
what in what town? You're in Houston?
No, here.
Here.
So like,
so he's at LaGuardia. So like, and you're at JFK.
I was at LaGuardia, and he was supposed to be at JFK, which is far.
Yeah.
And our flight, and like we were like maybe running late for our flight too.
Yeah.
So he leaves, misses the flight, couldn't catch the next flight on like standby till way later in the day. The fucking show is getting pushed back so far that people are starting to leave. And like the openers who all got extended sets have run out of time. They're like, yo, you have to play. But Goldeneye was not only my producer, he was my DJ. So I couldn't play my music. I didn't have it at all. He literally showed up like halfway through our set time. That's by far the latest I've ever had an artist pull up on me for anything.
But halfway through, instead of, you know, 2 hours afterwards, I guess, he half got it.
So, and I had gotten there like at like 2 p.m. or something. So he was like 8 hours late. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he missed the sound check.
He missed everything. And then we had to like go back home the next morning. Yeah. Like, bro, just, you know, send me the files and just call it a day, man. You're not going to make it. But he also was like, yo, I'm going to make it, man. Trust me, I'm going to make it. I'm going to play the show. Oh,
man. And honestly, I guess that kind of like makes me think about, too, just like talking about working with people, whatever. And you brought up how you work with all these different people. It's always a collaboration, right? And, you know, you already mentioned you did a Paul Wall thing, right? Like you already, like, I know you've done Das Racist, like you've done like kind of like pretty big collaborations or whatever. I don't know exactly what my question is, but like, is there a certain type of musician you love to collaborate with? Like, are you always looking for something that's the most different, or it's just like, oh, I'm a fan of this right now, so I want to do this right now? Or is it more just like you're just kind of rolling with like life and where it brings you and whatever? Like, how do you approach like what your like ideal types of collaborations are, I guess.
I love working with fellow music nerds. Like all the people that you named from really in the ASAP crew, it was Yams that brought me in to work with Rocky. And I met Yams on the internet talking about like really niche underground regional rap music. Working with Bun B, who's a huge music nerd. Paul Wall in the same way. Das Racist, obviously nerds. They went to Wesleyan. You know what I mean? Those are the type of people that I love. People who can geek out on music the same way I do.
Yeah, that makes sense. Speaking of geeking out on new music, or just music in general, you have kind of new music.
Oh, yeah.
Can we talk about I Will Make a Baby in This Damn Economy?
Definitely. So on that album, I did two things that I'm really proud of. One, that's the album where me and the producer Tadex have opened up our sound to so many collaborators. Like throughout all the tracks, There's people playing instruments. There's other people making beats alongside Tadex. Like, it felt like we had a house band making this record. Another thing I'm really proud of.
And where'd you make it?
Made it in LA. Word. And I think what made that record different than me and Tay's first album, Wake Up, is on this album, he has his own studio now. So we could go in there anytime, day or night, whereas previously we were using my publisher's studio. So it was really based on their schedule and like other artists getting in there, other writers getting in there. So we really didn't have time to stretch out. Whereas on this album, we could try, like on this album, we made tons of songs that didn't make the record. Whereas with the first album, we kind of only had time to make like the 9 or 10 songs that made the album. You know what I mean? And I think having that freedom. Oh, and we also spent much longer writing this album than the previous one. I think all of that was to our benefit and kind of has set us up to only work in that way from like now on so that we don't have anything limited. We don't feel rushed. We're really trying to give it our all and give us time to make a song, sit on it for a month, play it back and really think like, oh, should we change this? You know what I mean? Like, really giving us the flexibility to edit ourselves and bringing in other players to come make music with us who might execute certain things better than us. Like, you know, rather than me singing, let me bring in a real ass singer to sing something that I wrote. Let me bring in a co-writer to help me work on this hook. Like, making this record was all about how can we level up in the way that we've made music. Because me and him, we've only been making music since like 2017 together. And the Wake Up album that came out in 2020 is our only full-length project together. So I really feel like even though we've known each other for years, a few years now, you know what I mean, been making tons of music, but I don't think that we are all the way to our max capacity yet. And I think that this album, at least in my heart right now, is the perfect stepping stone of what we want to do next.
Tell me what the hell the name of it means.
So the album title is really about how no matter what we're up against, what type of problems, stress, money, health, I really believe in having an optimistic view. Like, I'm the type of person that always feels like I'm going to win. I'm going to make this happen. This is going to be a good song. This is going to be a great show. This is going to be a great tour. Like, always
this
leading.
This is going to be a great day.
Yeah, this is going to be a great day. Seriously, I like really deeply feel that. And I think a big part of it is because I'm blown away by how far I've gotten in life. Like, the fact that I'm even sitting here at this table with you is a part of everything that I've put into myself and put into music. I never left Texas till I made music. I never got on an airplane till I made music. Almost every money-making opportunity I've had in my life at its root was music. Even if the money didn't come from music, it came from an opportunity I got because someone knows about me because of my music. You know what I mean? So I'm forever grateful for all of that. And I think a way to show my gratitude is feeling like I have earned what is coming next and that I can take on whatever challenge comes my way as an artist.
Yeah. And it's also just such a good, in this economy, you
exactly.
know what I mean? Like, it's such a good, like one of my favorite phrases ever, to be honest.
I mean, it came from the,
and you kind of flipped it up.
It like came from the song Make a Baby when I'm like, I did 23andMe back in May. Found that I'm predominantly African in my DNA. Since that day, my spirit been trying me. It wants to impregnate 5 women and start a dynasty. And that's an eye roll moment. I ain't tripping. I will make a baby in this damn economy. But I got a type and she's it, the shit, nothing less. She's the best, so the kid she get. You know what I mean? I was really looking for like an album title that could come from a lyric. And with everything I said in mind, going through the songs, that one stuck out at me like, that's what this motherfucker is about.
Yeah, I love that. What, you did 23andMe?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, how was that?
I fucking love it. I am 90% African, which is rare for a Black American. You know, I feel blessed. This is amazing. Like, when I saw that, I was so geeked. For real. I was like, yo, this is not... You don't see this every day. You know what I mean? Now my dad, he's like 100% African. But as an American, 90% is pretty fucking high up there.
Did you guys... Did multiple, I don't know, I never done this. Like, do you just do it for you, or do you do it for like your family, or like?
Well, I got into it because my mom is really into it. My like mom is really into learning the history of our family. Mm-hmm. Like, she's done 23andMe. She's on ancestry.com. She like writes to people if they have a match. You know what I mean? She'll like look up like the old census records, like. She'll like document this stuff and pass it around to our family members, you know, not just in our home, but our extended family too. And I think for her, it's just a way to really find out where we come from. Because there was always like, you know, like every family, there's like rumors. Like, there was a rumor in my family that we were part Native, or that we had some like Native in our bloodline.
Yeah.
And she was like, too. I want to find out if it's true. And she found out that it wasn't true. And I think that really sparked her to be like, well, what else can I learn about my family? Because so much that you know about your family is just passed down orally. Like, you know, like most of my great grandparents, right, who I barely knew, I only know about them in stories, and some of them are fantastical stories. And sometimes you want to know, is that shit even true? Is it a fib? And even if it is a fib, it's still cool, but yeah. I just want to know like who I am. I also have
a... And of course, the fib is part of who you are too, and on some level, which is totally. Always interesting, you know?
I also have a godmother who was adopted. And our whole life, we thought that she was half Black and half Asian. Turns out, she's 100% Puerto Rican, and her real parents were from New York. Mind-blowing shit. You know what I mean? Something like that, where like, even my godmother, as a middle-aged woman, is finding out who she is for the first time. That's why we're into the ancestry shit and genealogy and learning about all that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. All right. 23andMe, ancestors.com. We're out here. Scene Report.
Yo, sponsor this fucking podcast, y'all. Stop playing.
Sponsor Fat Tony's next DJ night in fucking New York, and let's go.
Yo, we out. That's good. We just in the club giving out DNA.
Straight up. If everyone could do the test, you just swab right there, right?
That'd be wild.
Pull actually. Up. That'd Pull be the fuck wild. Up.
Yo.
DNA night.
Free entry with your DNA. Let's go.
We're going to use it for something crazy, but...
Oh, yeah. Using it for good.
And then I also just want to ask you, like, getting back to what we were talking about a minute ago, just the last track on the record. Yeah. And you don't necessarily need to tell me the whole story of the last track on the record, because if people want to go look up the story of James Byrd Jr. in 1998 and you want to hear some fucked up shit,
yeah,
you can do that, or feel free to tell us, whatever's good. But like, I'm curious also what I listened to another interview about, where you were just kind of talking about like the responsibility of an artist, or even just the responsibility of a person to speak on what you're seeing, to witness what you're seeing, to when an atrocity happens, to speak up. I don't know if that's if you were really getting at it as an artist or just as an individual or whatever, you know, but it's like, we're sitting here, it's what's today's date? October 20th, you know, there's a fucking war going on in the Middle East, and we were chatting about that for a little while. We don't necessarily need to break that down in the next 3 minutes before I turn this thing off or whatever, but it's like, you know, we got like, I've been in the middle of conversations throughout the day because there's supposed to be like a general strike today. So punk bands are like, are we supposed to cancel the show? Not supposed to cancel the show. We're supposed to do something else. Really? No, they ended up canceling it, you know? And I'm like, facts. That's cool. That's cool that you did something, even though like, whatever, there's all sorts of shit going on. Right. But it's like, I don't know. What do you think? Like, people talk a lot about having a platform. People talk a lot about responsibility. People also talk about like, nobody's responsibility, you know what I mean? Like, there's also like a level of like, you're just a person and you're living in the world, and there's a lot, you know, these companies that took their signs down, right? Isn't really the responsibility on them. I'm just curious, because you were kind of talking about like what your personal like relationship is to like when you see injustice and how you make art about it or how you speak about it. And then you put like a track like this at the end of your song where it's like, this is like important, you know what I mean? It happened a long time ago also. So like, we don't need to be talking about this right now, but I'll bet a lot of people don't know that person's name. So it's
I would love to talk about this. Personally, I feel like the responsibility one has to speak up about suffering or an injustice that's happened around them really falls on them. I know that some people are not comfortable talking about that stuff, and that's fine. Some people are comfortable talking about that stuff, and that's great. I chose to talk about the lynching of James Byrd Jr. because it's a very personal story to me. You know, like that happened when I was in fifth grade, and it was probably in third or second grade when I first learned about the Jim Crow era and like the Ku Klux Klan and all that stuff. And then to be like 9 or 10 years old and then hear how brutally these guys murdered James Byrd Jr. simply because he was a black man really shocked me, because you would hear about lynchings and stuff as like a thing that happened decades ago. But to have it happen in modern times and in my state, and it's in a small town that's not that far of a drive out of Houston, it really hit home for me. And I chose to write the Jasper, Texas song because there's a painter in Houston named L. Franco Lee II, and he has a series of paintings about the murder of James Byrd Jr., and they're very graphic. They like show how as these men chained him to this truck and dragged him through this rural area, he was having limbs rip off and all type of horrible things happened that disfigured and mutilated his entire body. And I, of course, I've never seen photos of like the real incident. Seeing those paintings is the first time that it really dawned on me how graphic and how violent this incident really was. And I was in the studio and my friend Lucas was playing like a lap steel, pedal steel guitar. And what he was playing sounded like wind, right? And in my imagination, just hearing him play that instrument and just picturing wind, I saw myself like at a pond or something. And it just dawned on me, it was like, wow, what if James Byrd Jr.'s spirit was talking to me through the wind? Just a random thought. And then I thought back to those L. Franco Lee II paintings that I had seen maybe just like a few years prior. And I thought, you know, I have to write about this straight up. So I'm not taking it upon myself to write about every murder, every lynching, but because I have a personal tie to this incident and it's something that's like,
and you heard the fucking guitar.
Yeah, you know, it like really spoke to me in a way that I felt like this is a way for me to further show you who I am. Because I think mostly someone my age who was a kid when that happened, this story would resonate with them the same way it did with me. You know what I mean? Like, it's like if I, like now, if a black man's murdered for a bigoted reason, it seems more commonplace. But to be a child and hear about that stuff and really believe that that was like a thing of the past and it happens, it's like, damn, could that be me? You know what I mean? It's just some wild thoughts for like a 9-year-old. But but that's what I was thinking back then, to the point that I always remember that.
And like, I read a little bit of like, reviews or whatever of your record, and it's like I think some people were sort of pontificating on like putting that track at the end of the record is like, I'm gonna have a child in this economy, by the way, like there's still this, right? But like also just like having our conversation, like I'm like anticipating, it's like, by the way, this is still happening. By the way, I'm still having my dynasty and my six babies. So fuck y'all.
I mean, I think just because there's the potential for danger in the world doesn't mean you shouldn't take a chance. Like yesterday, I was doing this daytime event with Volcom and we had a bunch of skaters there, right? And some of the skaters were really young and really little. And this one kid looked like he couldn't have been older than like 6 or 7 or 8 years old, right? And there was a girl hanging out with like me and my friends. And she was like, man, I am so scared seeing that kid. It makes me scared to have children. I'd never want my child to be a skateboarder. Like, what if they get hurt? And I'm just like, you can't limit someone's opportunities because there's a potential for danger or for injury. Like any moment could be our fucking last day here. You know what I mean? Anything totally out of our control could hurt us, kill us, make us sick. You know what I mean? But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't live. And my answer to that is like, well, make your kid wear a helmet. Like, yeah. If you're really concerned, you can take them to a skate park, hang out with them, and make sure that they're wearing the gear so they don't hurt themselves too bad. But if you're in any type of sport, an athlete of any sort, you're probably going to hurt yourself. Like if you play basketball, you might tear your fucking ACL. If like you're a skater, you might break a bone. Like, if you play football, you might get CTE. You know what I mean? Shit can happen. But just try to protect yourself and give it a chance, man. Just don't give up. That's a waste.
For sure. You know, I got hella more questions, but I also think we're kind of ending our time here with this microphone on. I'm gonna skip.
Ask me anything, man.
I'm gonna skip them. I'm gonna skip working in A&R. I'm gonna skip Vice Live. I'm gonna skip Power Trip. I'm gonna skip Shaq DJing.
Wow.
But what I do have to ask you before I turn it over to you, if you have any last words that you want to say before we turn this thing off, is, you know, when did you realize that you and The Undertaker have the same birthday?
Literally last night as I was walking around with you, because I was telling you how The Undertaker went to the college I went to, the University of St. Thomas, and he used to be a basketball star there, which I always thought was funny because like most people our age, I grew up loving wrestling. I was obsessed with wrestling. Wrestling was like the coolest thing in the fucking world to me up until when I was 15. And I swear I told one of my childhood friends, do you want to come over and watch Raw? And he was like, he literally said to me, yo, wrestling is out. Pussy is in. And I was like, what? What is he talking about? And from that moment on, he never talked about wrestling with me ever again. Only girls.
I gotta shake that guy's hand.
But I looked up the Wikipedia of Undertaker. We got the same motherfucking birthday, March 24th. So I think that me and The Undertaker, both being from Houston, need to have a big fucking birthday bash in Houston, and we need Shaq, a.k.a. DJ Diesel, to DJ the party. Because he DJs at Houston clubs, by the way.
Yeah.
A fucking Shaq.
I thought it was just the festivals or whatever. He's in the club in Houston?
He's in clubs in Houston. There's footage. We need the Shaq Fat Tony Undertaker party March 24th, 2024 in Houston. We need that right now. Somebody get somebody on the fucking phone.
Numbers. All ages.
Yo, if we did it at numbers. Oh, bro. Okay, now you, okay.
Oh, wow. This is gonna be
I didn't even think about doing it at numbers, which is the best club.
That little kid who was skateboarding yesterday, he can come?
Yo, everyone definitely, come? Yeah.
Or is it 18 and up? I don't remember.
Man, my shit is all A's. It's just behave yourself. Don't be a dick. Don't make me regret letting you in my party. That's all I've got to say about that. But numbers, Beautiful place. I'm so happy that it's still open. If you don't know what Numbers Nightclub is in Houston, look it up right now. It's one of the most important venues in Houston history, world history. It's where I saw my very first concert when I was a teenager. My very first like nightclub concert, and it was fucking MF Doom. And that shit is amazing.
Okay. That's crazy. All right, Fat Tony, it's last words to you. Anything else you want to talk about?
Man, going back to something I said earlier, I think it's really important to have gratitude. And I think if you work in music or the arts, just think about how much music has given back to us and make sure that you give some of that back too. And you can give that back by making great material or helping out another artist, or being kind to someone, or learning a new skill in your genre. Like, always find a way to give back so that the music that has given so much to you can continue to give to others and push the whole shit forward.
That's it. You heard it here. Fat Tony, Scene Report. I'm your host, Reed Dunleap. Shout outs to Punjabi.
Yes.
Check us on the TikTok, the Instagram, the Reels at Punjabi last night.
Yes.
Late night. Before the afters.
Punjabi it was closed. Deli, baby.
It was closed after the afters.
Because we shut it down.
We shut it down. Free Palestine. Always. Every day. Always.
Free all oppressed people globally. No more suffering.
Facts. Fat Tony, you're the man. I appreciate you coming on.
You're a better man than me.
We'll catch you next time. Scene Report, Season 1, Episode 2 with Fat Tony. That is a wrap. Again, I'm your host, producer, engineer, editor, whatever, Reed Dunley, executive producer, Ash Tyner. We had no associate producer on this episode, but honestly, I feel like Fat Tony gets the associate producer credit this time around, because it was just me doing this one with Tony this time around. Didn't have a second hand, and Tony helped me put the banner up, which is a ridiculous thing to ask talent to do, but Tony offered. Thank you, Fat Tony, for being a good sport, DIY hustler, as always, doing whatever needs to be done to make the episode happen. We'll be back real soon, probably putting these episodes out about once a month. Next one's gonna be a fun one. You're gonna like it. Please, for real, if you could rate, review, and subscribe wherever you're listening to this podcast. That's not just a thing that we all say at the end of podcasts. If you could literally just go ahead and like rate, review, and subscribe to this. If you could throw us a follow, a comment, share, whatever on Instagram. Handle is protest, letter N, survive. We'll be back real soon. Thanks y'all for tuning in. This has been Scene Report.